right now on Current State, we'll remember a Michigan couple killed in the Texas church shooting.
I know they're okay where they're at now, but we will greatly miss them.
Learn why some adults may soon be cleared to carry guns inside Michigan schools. Hear from the new mayors of Lansing and Jackson.
This is the next version of Lansing where we've got new council members with new ideas.
There's a lot of passion and a lot of people that are really excited about Jackson's potential.
A blind critic takes us to the movies.
And I really believe that if you were to just listen to it and not watch it, you wouldn't miss much.
Plus, the crystal clear waters of Lake Michigan may not be a good thing. Current State on WKAR starts right after the news. From the WKAR studios at Michigan State University, this is Current State. Hello and welcome. I'm WKAR Digital News Director Reginald Hardwick. Sunday will mark 1 week since a gunman opened fire in a church near San Antonio, Texas, killing 26 people. Just days after that tragedy, lawmakers here in Michigan came closer to passing new laws that could allow guns in schools, bars, and other previously off-limits locations. We'll have more on that in a moment. But first, remembering the fallen in South Texas.
Counselors are now working in Sutherland Springs, Texas, trying to help people there cope with the tragedy.
Officials say 26-year-old Devin Kelly opened fire with an assault-type rifle.
Well, the tragedy really struck a lot of families. You see husbands, wives, children, teenagers, babies, grandparents, a woman who was pregnant.
Two of the people killed, Robert and Shani Corrigan, were Michigan natives. Last week, their hometown of Harrison in Clare County held a candlelight vigil. And Ben Thorpe from our NPR station WCMU was there.
They were very good people. They loved the Lord, and I know they're with him.
Roughly 60 people were in attendance to honor the lives of Robert and Shani Corrigan. The two met in the local school. Robert served 30 years in the Air Force, and the couple's two sons are also active duty military. Renee Haley is the director of Clare County Veteran Services and helped organize the event.
You know, I mean, it just goes to show you that even small town America is not immune to the tragedies that happen within America, and that fact that he and his whole family is deeply rooted in Clare County. You know, and he went to high school here. Him and his wife graduated together, high school sweethearts, which only adds to the tragedy of the situation.
Haley says it was important for the community to come out and support the Corrigan family. I'm Ben Thorpe.
Less than a week after the tragedy in Texas, Michigan legislators moved forward with new laws regarding people carrying guns in schools and other places. And joining us now to clarify is our Capitol Bureau Chief Rick Pluta.
Hello, Reginald.
So what was passed by the state Senate?
The state Senate passed a package of bills, and they did quite a few things, but I think the core of it is that it will allow, if it is adopted and signed into law, for people to carry concealed weapons and concealed pistols in a lot of places where they're not allowed to right now. Churches, stadiums, places like that, schools are part of it, although there's a question if there aren't other laws and rules that would maybe still allow superintendents and principals to keep people from carrying concealed weapons. And this started out as a fix for a quirk in the law, an anomaly. The law bans concealed weapons in schools, but the way that it's written, it allows people who have a concealed pistol license to openly carry a firearm in schools. And so there's been some confusion as to what the rules are and what's allowed and not allowed. And school officials have said that you know, it's disruptive when someone, you know, walks in with a pistol in a holster or slung over their shoulder or something like that. So the legislature went in to fix that, but Republicans said in exchange, one of the things that we're going to do is we're going to take these no carry zones and we're going to eliminate them and say that basically people can.
So for the record, this came up last week, but not as a result of the Texas church shooting, correct?
No. They were unrelated, and a decision was made, you know, not to allow the Texas tragedy to sideline this.
So you talked with Senator Majority Leader Meekhoff, the bill sponsor. Why is he so intent
on making the changes.
He is a true believer in that people have a Second Amendment right to carry firearms to defend themselves, and he's been a pretty ardent backer of this all along. And it was really just a question of, for him, of waiting for the right moment to move it along.
A lot of Democrats oppose this.
Yeah, these bills were adopted on largely party line votes. One Republican defected and said that the idea of allowing guns in schools was just a bit too much for him without at least an option for school boards or superintendents to be able to make a decision about whether or not that was appropriate for that district. Now, there are federal laws that come into play here, and the Michigan Association of School Boards and the Michigan Association of School Administrators advise their members that you can still say openly carrying guns or carrying guns at all in schools is not allowed. Of course, with, you know, concealed carry, the question is, how would you check that? How would you know to check that? And so Democrats put up a bunch of amendments. One of them came close to being adopted. I think it fell just one vote short. Right now, felons cannot get a concealed pistol license, but people who are convicted of misdemeanor domestic violence are not barred from it. And there was an amendment proposed that would take out misdemeanor, people convicted of a misdemeanor domestic assault charge would not be able to get a concealed pistol license, and that fell short, but that was a very, very close vote.
And I know a lot has been made nationally, some saying if you shouldn't be on the no-fly list, you shouldn't be able to carry a gun. Was that one of the amendments too?
That was also one of the amendments, and the argument against that one, it's a bit more nuanced. It's not that the argument is that the no-fly list can be kind of a sloppy bit of work, and people who don't necessarily pose a danger can wind up on it. What the Republicans argue in that case is that people shouldn't be denied a constitutional right, their Second Amendment right, because they happen to wind up on a list that's actually not very well curated.
So what happens next?
These bills now go to the State House, presumably with a Republican majority there, they'll be popular. The question is if and when the House will take it up. It won't be before the legislature's Thanksgiving break, I hear. And then, you know, Governor Rick Snyder has vetoed a similar bill to this before. And the question is whether or not the legislature is willing to send him a bill and risk that veto.
And we know you'll be on top of it no matter what.
We'll do our best.
Capitol Bureau Chief Rick Pluta.
A pleasure.
You are listening to Current State on WKAR. Two of Mid-Michigan's largest cities now have new mayors, and you are about to hear from both of them. First, Lansing elected State Representative Andy Shore to replace Virge Bonero, who did not seek re-election. Shore talked with Morning Edition host Brooke Allen about his expectations for his new role.
So I have to ask, is this the beginning of a new era of cooperation in the city?
It is. This is the next Lansing. We are going to have almost half of council is new. We'll have a new mayor. So it is. This is the next version of Lansing where we've got new council members with new ideas. We've got council members coming back who have been very positive in this campaign, have been helpful to me on all sides. You know, whether it was Patricia Spitzley or Jody Washington, Adam Hussein, Carol Wood, they've all been great to work with. I'm excited to have Kathy Dunbar back, and I think we're going to have a great team for Lansing.
So you campaigned on four main issues. So let's talk about some of those. First, city infrastructure and services. And you said one of the biggest themes you've heard from residents is the condition of Lansing's roads and also the sidewalks.
Yeah.
So how do you intend to work on that problem?
We're going to do two things. First, we're going to see what's been fixed recently. We have kind of an inventory of the roads, and we generally have an idea of the condition through what are called PACER ratings. But there's been some work done. If you go around the city, there's a lot of really bad roads, but there's some that have been fixed recently. I want to put out there to the residents so they know what's been fixed and what's coming. We're going to meet with residents throughout the city. We're going to meet with different neighborhoods and neighborhood associations, and we're going to talk about what's their priority. Is it the street in front of their house? Is it the corridor street? Is it the downtown? Because I've heard all of those. We're going to create a priority list, and we're going to cost it out, figure how much each road is to either patch or, you know, asphalt or reconstruct. And then we're going to start spending money on those fixes. And again, we're going to let the voters know and the residents know as we go what we're fixing, so they know how much in their neighborhood versus other neighborhoods.
Are you going to be the kind of mayor that's accessible?
Yeah. I've always done that as a state representative, as a county commissioner. You know, I've held coffee hours once a month for the last 5 hours, so I will be accessible. We're going to create what's called a citizen advocate, someone in my office who can take questions and concerns and navigate government. I have to work with council to create that position, but that's something that is high on my list.
You also mentioned access to grocery stores.
You know, you've got people that live, whether they live downtown or whether they live on near any of our corridor streets on the north or in the south or east or west, they want to have a grocery store they can get to pretty quickly without having to drive to one of the big box stores. You know, you're still going to do your once every 2 weeks or once a month big grocery trip, but if you come home and, you know, you need some milk, you need some eggs, you need some things to make some dinner or some breakfast for your family, you want that corner grocery store. And I've heard this numerous times. It's walkability. It's young people who are moving to our downtown who want a grocery store they can shop at, or whether it's for people who don't have cars or access to transportation who need to be able to get to that close grocery store for food for their families. It's very important.
How hands-on do you intend to be with the school district?
I plan to work very closely with our superintendent. You know, I've got both my kids in the Lansing schools. One of the bigger issues that we see is, you know, Lansing schools have been really coming alive, right? Everybody's got their story about 10 or 15 years ago, the problems they had. With the new pathways that we have in place that the voters supported with a sizable vote when we had our millage a few years ago, you know, when you hear how excited people are to have a Chinese immersion program or an international baccalaureate program or new tech or a public Montessori, these are things that we need to talk about and share with people. When you have folks who want to move into Lansing, you know, and the first thing I hear is, well, we were going to move into Lansing, but we heard the schools weren't so good, so we moved somewhere else. That, to me, is a problem economically and socially. So we're going to address that. We're going to talk about the great things going on. We're going to help Lansing schools to sell what they're doing, and at the same time, work with them to provide resources for those who need them, who need mentoring and tutoring and other things. So I plan to work very closely. I'm not going to be the superintendent, and I'm not going to be a school board member, and they do a great job. So I'm going to work closely with them to make sure that our schools are an integral part of how we sell Lansing to those outside and how we talk about our own city to those who live here.
Well, again, congratulations, Lansing Mayor-elect Andy Shore. And you officially start the job January 1st.
January 1st. Thank you.
Now let's head south to Jackson, and that is where Derek Dobies defeated Bill Jors to become the new mayor. And he joins us now here in the studio. Welcome to Current State.
Thanks for having me on. Excited to be here.
Congratulations. And my first question is, how does it feel?
I finally caught my breath. It feels great. I'm honored to serve and excited to get to work to face some of our city's biggest problems.
So what is your first priorities as mayor?
Well, I think that we have a couple of new council members that I look forward to continuing to talk with and talk about their priorities. But, you know, a lot of the problems that we talked about during the campaign are the same. You know, getting our streets fixed, dealing with the crime and drug problem that we have. There's a lot of excitement in the city. There's a lot of passion and a lot of people that are really excited about Jackson's potential, and I think it's something that we want to capitalize on.
I did look at the population over the years in from a height of around 36,000 around the turn of the century to about 32,000 now. How do you attract new business, and are there any new developments in place right now?
Sure. Well, you know, we used to be a city of 55,000 people, so we've had a huge decline, lost about 40% of our population, and of the remaining people that are left, about 40% lives under the federal poverty level. So we have some big structural barriers to our progress that we have to work on. But, you know, I think largely we want to attract people and new businesses to the city in the same way that you see other communities doing that, focusing on their urban cores, making their downtowns a lot more attractive through creative placemaking projects, through incentivizing the building of new economic development projects, through reinvesting in our own infrastructure. Those are some things that we've already started to do.
Your husband and a dad to a toddler. So how does this change your life becoming a mayor? Because city council is a few less hours.
Yeah. You know, I've had the opportunity over the past couple of terms to be elected by my colleagues as the vice mayor. So I've had a little bit of experience in being a leader on council. And I see this as an opportunity to really get out there and showcase what Jackson has to offer, help lead the council, and, you know, help be the biggest advocate for Jackson and a leader in the community to, you know, move our city forward. And I think that it's great to have my family standing behind me and, you know, the things that I want to do for others in the city of fixing our infrastructure and combating crime and drugs and things like that are things that I want for my own family, too.
This year, Jackson became the newest Michigan city to enact a non-discrimination ordinance based on sexual orientation and gender identity. Mm-hmm. There are some people who are still a little sore about that. So, you know, has Jackson moved past that, or are there still some areas to kind of bring the city together?
Sure. I don't think on any issue we're going to have total agreement, but I do believe that it's, you know, it's 2017. A number of people that I talked to throughout the campaign and just the conversation that we've had over the past year in the community has really driven home the fact that people want to live in a tolerant, inclusive city that views diversity as a strength. And I think that numerous times over the course of this past year, whether it was at the city council meeting where we passed the NDO in front of 700 people from the community, whether it was through, you know, combating the effort to repeal the ordinance, through my recall effort, through the election to mayor, I think that the residents in Jackson and the business community, I mean, we had Consumers Energy and Allegiance Health, Henry Ford, that stood up and said, yes, this is something that we care about. We see this as something that can attract more business and more talented people to the city. And, you know, over and over again, people stood behind the non-discrimination ordinance as something of value and something that they wanted to see in the city and help the city to progress.
Well, thank you for joining us. That is Mayor-elect Derek Dobies.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Can the arts influence thinking on scientific debates like the discussion surrounding climate change? A program in Lansing this week aims to do exactly that. WKAR's Scott Pohl has a look at climate change theater action.
The program is called Hope Takes the Stage, and organizer Melissa Kaplan says it's part of a worldwide series of readings and performances of short climate change plays coinciding with the UN Conference of the Parties. She explains.
Climate change theater action includes the word action, and part of the intent of these events is that people will be able to take action when they leave. And that might be a very personal action of changing some small thing that they do. It could be increasing recycling. It could be getting information from some of the resources that we're going to have available. One of the things that anybody in the public can do is encourage their the candidates who are running in their district and their state to answer these questions and let these people know that this is important to them and it's important to their neighbors and it's important to voters, and voters are going to consider that when they make their decisions next year at the polls.
An organization called Science Debate is a partner in the Lansing program. Cheryl Kirschenbaum is executive director.
Science Debate is a nonpartisan initiative that encourages candidates running for office to address science policy issues prior to Election Day. So we've been around for a decade. We've worked with every presidential candidate starting in 2008 to answer a set of science policy questions that we put forth with the National Academies and AAAS and a bunch of big science institutions. Because the idea is that for democracy to work, we need to be as informed as we possibly can be. So 2018, we're opening up 10 questions to every candidate running for House, Senate, and governor across the United States. We announced this just a couple weeks ago, and we're already getting some candidates' responses, and they're all going to be on our website at sciencedebate.org.
So where does theater fit in? Melissa Kaplan tells me the process required the winnowing down of options provided by the global organization.
Climate Change Theater Action, the organizers solicited plays from playwrights around the world. There are 50 plays. They are from 25 different countries and cultures, and they are 1 to 5 minute plays. You need to pick at least one of those plays. I read all the plays. I had my top 10. I immediately thought of Anna Szabo, who is an LCC theater alum, still a student there working as a supplemental instructor. I've seen her on stage. I've seen the work that she's directed, and I thought she'd be a good collaborator. She read those 10. She picked her top two, and she's directing those two. Heath Sartorius is an actor in one of her plays, and there was another play that just kind of stuck with me that I really wanted us to do, and I thought he'd be a good director for that. So these are 1 to 5 minute plays. I think the ones that we're doing are probably more in the 4 to 5 minute play range. There's one that is a one-woman piece, and I think of it really as a mother's lament and her hope for the future. It's by a Scottish playwright, Claire Duffy. Another one is a bit tongue-in-cheek with a professor kind of questioning and riffing with a Sappho-like figure. And then the third is somewhat comic, but a bit pointed, and it is called Homo Sapiens. It's by Chantal Bilodeau. She is one of the co-founders of this event. It's a look, if we were to have our descendants 6 generations out looking at us, that is what that play's all about. That's called Homo Sapiens. So it's a nice mix of mood and performance in those three pieces.
There also will be a piece by performance artist Scott Crandall called Visions for the End of the World.
I see him coming. Quetzalcoatl, the ancient Mayan god, late from a failed 2012 doomsday, but coming now and soon. He won't be the Quetzalcoatl of old. He will be made of junk mail. Hot deals on his glossy wings to bring us salvation and savings from pesky mortality and horrific monotony with 58-inch flat screens at just $799.99.
Scott Crandall's performance piece is extremely imaginative and moving. It's a little bit more abstract in that it's based on poetry. It does tell the story. It tells the story of a shipwrecked prophet in the future who is maybe returning to the past or maybe going forward. And it's not clear what happened, but he's exploring that, what happened in the past, what's possible in the future. And Scott has built this piece over a number of years, performed it in a variety of places, worked with the Hinterlands Experimental Theater in Detroit, and it's based on his poetry and original music, and he's a really dynamic performer. I found this piece very intriguing. It's funny, it's dark, and I leave with a sense of hope.
Hope Takes the Stage, Climate Change Theater Action, is Tuesday night at 7:30 at the Robin Theater in Lansing. For WKAR News, I'm Scott Pohl.
Feeling like a 10, the best I ever been. And yeah, I know how bad it must hurt to see me like this, but it gets worse. Now you're out here.
Just ahead on Current State, the MSU men's basketball team opens their season this weekend. Find out why they hope to get people talking with something they're wearing. Plus, adoptees searching for families.
My history and my life is a puzzle. And if I can find out little pieces, great.
Learn how technology is helping Vietnamese orphans meet their biological parents and my very own personal connection to this story. And later, we'll meet Tommy Edison.
I mean, like Goodfellas, for example, is one of my favorite movies of all time. And I really believe that if you were to just listen to it and not watch it, You wouldn't miss much.
Hear why a YouTube film critic is challenging the way we experience movies. Another half hour of Current State on WKAR is headed your way right after this.
Baby, I'm so-